Morning. We want to welcome our students from Green Lake High School. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. It's still snowing.
Yes, it's snowing.
You may be seated. And these students who have braved the weather, coming and returning home, have been invited to participate in this oral argument. It's part of a national award-winning program called Court with Class. Students across the state are invited to come. If they accept the invitation, then we send them copies of the brief of the case they're about to hear. They may engage in various activities relating to the case. They come and listen to oral argument. And then they meet with a justice of the court right after this oral argument. Everyone is invited to attend this session with the justice. The discussion will center on the procedure the court uses, not the substantive issues presented in this case. If anyone would like a summary of the case, the marshal has such a summary. If you'd raise your hand, you can have one. All right. Thank you. While the marshal is distributing the summary, let me introduce the court to each of you. Starting on the far left is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice Patience Robinsack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. Justice Crooks is the justice with whom you're going to meet at noon today. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her right, Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, we will now call our second case for today, 05AP2935, Tanisha Larry versus Derek L. Harris and others. Arguing on behalf of Ms. Larry is attorney Alan Stephen Porter. Mr. Porter, you may proceed.
Justice Abrahamson, members of the court, I'm appearing today on behalf of the plaintiff petitioner, Tanisha Larry, and will represent to you that this case addresses the application of WISSTAT's 806071H to default judgments. Tanisha Larry is asking this court to provide appropriate guidelines to litigants and trial courts so as not to make it easier to reopen a default judgment than it is to avoid the imposition of one in the first place. Defendant Carlos Rutherford was served with a summons and complaint in this action, but he chose not to appear to plead within the time provided by the statute for doing so. He was served with a motion for default judgment, but he chose not to appear to contest the motion or to move the court for an extension of time to file an answer under 801.15.2a. Do so would have required him to show good cause and excusable neglect, as well as the availability of a meritorious defense on the merits. But first, he would have been required to show good cause and excusable neglect before the court could even consider a meritorious defense. Default judgment was entered against Mr. Rutherford, a Milwaukee police officer, sworn to uphold the law, but he chose not to appear to move the court to reopen under Wisconsin statutes 80607. Carlos Rutherford never appeared in this case. He only appeared in the Court of Appeals pursuant to an order to show cause. His co-defendant, Mr. Harris, another police officer, did appear, but belatedly, after the motion for default judgment was filed, and satisfied the court with regard to good cause and excusable neglect, and was permitted to answer and proceed with his defense. The court dismissed Tanisha's Larry case against Officer Harris on summary judgment based on a finding that qualified immunity applied. Qualified immunity is an affirmative defense that must be pleaded by the defendant or it is waived.
Was Mr. Rutherford advised about the Harris proceeding on the merits?
I'm not aware whether he was or not, Your Honor. But I know that
the default was opened. They then allowed time for affidavits, I assume?
In a paragraph appended at the end of the decision in order on summary judgment, the trial court simply said that sua sponte, that he was going to reopen the default judgment and dismiss the case against Officer Rutherford.
No, he but I want to know about notice. The Harris, in the Harris summary judgment.
Yes. Did he appear? No. His deposition was never taken.
Who's he?
Rutherford's deposition, I'm sorry, was never taken, and neither was any affidavit supported by either side from Officer Rutherford in the summary judgment.
But there were affidavits as to Harris?
I'm sorry?
There were affidavits as to Harris?
There were affidavits submitted by Harris. I believe his deposition was taken, yes.
Okay.
And I believe there was a deposition of another unnamed officer. There was a pleading, in the pleading, there was an unnamed officer, and that officer's deposition was also taken.
And Miss Larry was part of that proceeding against Mr. Harris?
Yes, she was the plaintiff.
Right. And does she submit affidavits?
Yes, she did, as well as other witnesses, and her deposition was taken.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So she participated in that summary judgment?
Yes,
okay.
She did.
However,
her attorneys believed at the time that they need not build their case against Officer Rutherford because they had a default judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Default judgment means that by defaulting, the defendant has waived or admitted the allegations of the complaint. And all that is left at that point, as the order for default judgment stated, is to proceed to a hearing on damages. The law says that Mr. Rutherford would be entitled to appear at that hearing and had to be given notice of that hearing and could appear and fully contest the damage issue but could not contest the liability issue anymore unless he was to file a motion under 80607 and persuade the court that under one of the factors involved there, that he should be allowed to have the judgment reopened. He never did that.
Mr. Porter, don't you think it's significant in all of this that the nature of that default judgment against the officer was interlocutory in nature? It wasn't finalized as to all respects?
It was not a final appealable judgment under 80803. We concede that. But we also would assert that it was in no way conditional or temporary in any regard. It disposed of the liability issues by its terms. And under the law, those issues were decided. They're deemed admitted by the defendant when he fails to answer within the 20 days. Or
As to the other officer, was there any appeal of the finding of the circuit court that qualified immunity applied and that summary judgment should be granted in favor of the other officer?
No. No. What we are appealing, though, is after the trial court reopened, the trial court went ahead based on Harris's motion for summary judgment and granted a dismissal, presumably a summary judgment against Rutherford as well, without any opportunity for the plaintiffs to pursue Mr. Rutherford or take evidence from him. We would maintain that that it would have been improper unless Mr. Rutherford appeared.
Wasn't there a reconsideration motion and a hearing and notice in regard to that?
Yes, there was. There was a when Mr. Rutherford, or I'm sorry, Ms. Larry's attorneys read the summary judgment decision. They wrote to the court and said, "Is there some mistake?" The court said, "If you have a motion, file it." So the attorneys filed a motion for reconsideration. It was briefed. Mr. Rutherford did not appear to brief it, but the city of Milwaukee was allowed to appear as some sort of a friend of the court or interested party of some kind to argue on behalf of sustaining the default or the reopening of the default and the dismissal of the case. And the judge decided that, not to change his mind. He decided that he would maintain the default.
Was the city of Milwaukee in any way indicating in their appearance that they were now representing the officers involved?
No. They did represent Harris because under 895.46 of the statutes, they're compelled to provide a defense to any officer of the county or the city that gets that is sued, and they're compelled to indemnify that officer for any damages, including punitive damage.
Why didn't that cover Officer Rutherford?
It did. I mean, it would have if he would have appeared. Under 1983, Your Honor, federal 1983 action, you can sue the municipality, but the municipality is a separate person. You can also sue the individual officer that you allege has offended your constitutional rights. And that's what Ms. Larry chose to do. So the city was not a party, but they were responsible under state statute, under 895.46, for any damages, and they were responsible to provide a defense to both officers, which is one of the reasons why we feel that the Court of Appeals erred when it took the first two factors of the MLB versus DGH case and construed them as being neutral. Those factors pertain to whether Rutherford made a conscious decision not to appear or whether he had access to counsel. Under 895.46, he clearly had access to counsel, free counsel, and his colleague chose to make use of it, but he chose not to. He chose to simply default on any. In a way, we would, as the dissent said, I think, as Judge Fine's dissent said, he thumbed his nose at the court and simply did not make use of the resources that he had to appear and to maintain a defense.
Could I ask, there were two officers who did not respond, at least initially. That doesn't quite make sense to me if they have free counsel available. What am I entitled to ask why?
Your Honor, it doesn't make sense to me either. There's nothing in the record to explain it. There were some documents not in the record that gave us an indication that something was going on, but I don't think it's really pertinent to this opinion.
In any way, you don't care.
Right.
If he's represented or not represented, that's not your issue as long as you served him properly. That's right. His problem, right? You don't get him counsel.
Right. It's our issue, though, as far as it goes to the factors in MLB
okay.
in terms
well,
of...
Well, here's my question to you. You've now set the stage as I hear your argument. Now, you got two issues. One... should that default have been opened? Sua sponte, right? And the second one is, even if the default were opened properly, should a summary judgment have been entered?
That's correct.
Okay, so let's take number one first.
All right, well, there's no question that trial court may, sua sponte, under 806.07, reopen a judgment. Never been applied to a default, however. And the one case that did recognize the opportunity for a court to open sua sponte took place where there was a modification of one of the findings or conclusions in the judgment after a five-day trial. In that case, the defendant had appeared and had litigated for 5 days, and all the parties had a full and fair opportunity to litigate that case. And the defendant had appeared. If a defendant is served with a summons and complaint and needs more time to answer, that defendant must come to the court and ask for an extension of time under 801.15 sub 2 and must show good cause to reopen.
Counselor, the first argument to me goes to the power of the court. Could the court do it? Okay, that's part of the question. Did they have the power to do it? And you're saying, yeah, but they've never done it in a default judgment. And then you slide into what the defendant should have done to avoid the default judgment. So just looking at the power part of the first issue, if the court has the power to do it with a judgment entered after a jury trial, why doesn't the court have the power, just the court's power, to do it in a default judgment situation?
To a sponte.
We're saying
that's what we're talking about, obviously.
Well, we're saying that the court has to follow the two-step process that's set out in MLB versus DGH. And we're asking the court to clarify that, in fact, that would apply in this situation.
But I look at that case as what the defendant had to do. And I know that's part of whether this was properly opened or not. I just want to focus on the first part. Does the court have the power, sua sponte, to do this? Not whether it should have done it in this case, just whether it has the power to open a default judgment. Now, you're telling me that, yeah, it's done it in other judgments, and you agree the court can do it. I don't understand why the power of the court is any different in a default judgment.
Yes, the court would have the power to reopen a default judgment, sua sponte.
Okay, so we're not worried about the court's power. The court can do it.
Right, we're saying that the court abused its discretion in doing so because the only basis for doing so was a promising or availability of a meritorious defense. And what we're saying is that
they got to do the excusable neglect deal first, right?
The extraordinary circumstances step in the two-step process to reopen incorporates, although not explicitly, excusable neglect, which is in 807.1a, but it does incorporate the idea when you look at the cases that are referred to in MLB. When you look at all the cases pertaining to this, it does require that there be some finding that there was excuse for the defendant not to appear. If that's not the case, if all you got to do is say, "Hey, I've got a good defense," you come back anytime you want, or even within 1 year, and say that, you're giving a signal to the parties in any litigation that don't file for the motion for extension of time because you got to show good cause. Don't file after the time has run for leave to answer and to not have a default entered against you, because then you got to show good cause and excusable neglect before the court can even consider whether you have a defense or not. Instead, a defense counsel is going to be encouraged by this case to advise their clients, sit on it. Wait till the plaintiff gets a default judgment against you, and then we'll come back and we'll move under 806.071H, and we'll just say we've got a good defense. And the interests of justice say that we should have a chance to have that defense considered.
So what you're really arguing is that the law has already been decided about how the exercise of discretion in opening a default judgment is applied, and this judge didn't follow it.
The judge abused his discretion because in the first instance, he didn't give notice. Now, Gittle, there's an argument about whether that can be cured. We don't think it can be cured by a motion for reconsideration. But the important point is that the judge did not follow the two-step process that is first set forth in MLB and later developed in other cases like Johnson v. Johnson and others that say that you have to first hold a hearing to determine whether factors exist, and the defendant has to prove those factors that establish ordinary circumstances as a threshold before you can even get to the questions of whether justice or the interests of justice would would make it appropriate to reopen. And, of course, Johnson says even if you get to that point, it's not automatic. The judge is not bound to reopen. The judge can still say there are other equities involved here. And in this case, I think the key equity is the defendant never bothered to appear. How can a plaintiff shadow box against a shadow that doesn't appear? How can a plaintiff, even on a motion to reconsider, try to make a case about somebody who's not there?
On an exercise of discretion, does the equity of the court's view of the equity of what's going on in a particular case have any bearing?
The equity definitely does have a bearing, and of course there's a specifically equitable considerations under sub 1G of the statute. But in terms of the reopening, the first threshold step, I think that I don't know if the term would be equity or not, but it certainly if you look at the five factor list that's set out in MLB, the last one has to do with whether it would be unfair, really, to the plaintiff from an equitable standpoint to find extraordinary circumstances. So part of the extraordinary circumstances process should take into account the prejudice to the plaintiff or the effect on the plaintiff or the effect on the public or whatever else might be appropriate to include. But I think our point is that it needs to include something of the magnitude of excusable neglect or something that is extraordinary enough to justify why the defendant didn't bother to show up in the first place.
Mr. Porter, yes. As a practical matter, you are asking us to reinstate the default judgment and to remand the case for a hearing on damages. Is that right?
That's correct.
And I think you've acknowledged that Officer Rutherford could move to reopen the default judgment at that point under 80607. Is that
presumably
right?
Presumably he could. Yeah.
But given the facts of the case as we know them, what kind of damages would you expect if the case wasn't reopened? I mean, if the default judgment was not reopened, what kind of damages would you expect?
Well, Ms. Larry alleged damages of an emotional distress nature, primarily in punitive damages, which are awardable under 42 U.S. Code Section 1983.
Would this officer be responsible for all of the damages that she suffered?
All of the damages that were proved to be caused by the violation alleged in her complaint.
What about the city on day 8? 9546?
Yep.
It would be our contention that they would be liable indirectly by virtue of indemnification.
Sure.
I think the city might have a different position on that. But
sure.
Counsel, let's get to the second issue while we have a few minutes left, and that is the assertion that under the circumstances the trial court erred when it entered summary judgment in the defendant's favor.
Yes, Your Honor, as this court knows, there's a high burden, really, on defendants to establish summary judgment or a basis for summary judgment. And the first is, under the Grams v. Voss case, is you look to see whether the pleadings join the issues. There's no pleading here. What you have in effect here is that the court has to essentially supply a pleading which it did not elaborate in writing but must have understood in its head. And then, in addition to that, would have had to plead the affirmative defense on behalf of Rutherford of qualified immunity. We all know that affirmative defenses are waived if they're not pled. It was never pled. The burden of proof on an affirmative defense is on the defendant, not on the plaintiff. And in order to enter a default judgment, the court would have to determine that the complaint states
summary
a claim.
Summary judgment
we're talking about?
Enter summary judgment.
Right, but what I'm trying to say, Your Honors, is that as part of the qualified immunity rubric and process, the court has to first determine that there is a claim stated for a constitutional violation. So this is not a an instance, as some of the briefs have tried to suggest, of a frivolous claim or a non-meritorious claim. And at the time of granting the summary or the default judgment, the court would have had to determine that the complaint actually did state a claim. So the court has already decided that. The affirmative defense is not pled, and I guess the court, we have to presume that the court presumed to plead the defense for Rutherford.
You asserted or responded to a question that the court has the power, Justice Rogensack asked you, the court has the power to vacate a default judgment sui sponte. And you said, does acknowledge the question is whether or not there was an erroneous exercise of discretion in exercising that power.
Right.
Does the court have the power to sui sponte enter a summary judgment?
We would argue no, that it does not. That there has to be a standard, there has to be a pleading, there has to be an answer, that the issues have to be joined. There has to be a finding that under no circumstances, or the Grahamsby-Voss case uses the words beyond a reasonable doubt, that the plaintiff could not establish contested issues of fact on any of the elements of their complaint.
Well, and, but you had the Harris matter was opened up. Your client had notice of the opening up. There was a summary judgment proceeding in the Harris. Your client participated in that. Why doesn't the Harris case, in which your client participated, in effect govern summary judgment here?
Because
whether you call it, and I haven't thought this through, issue preclusion, claim preclusion, or something else.
Right.
Stare decisis, or whatever.
Law of the case, maybe, but the
law of the case. Okay.
Because it is true that qualified immunity takes into account what a reasonable police officer would have known. It nevertheless has to be determined under the circumstances of the case, of the particular case, and therefore, the qualified immunity that the court found for Harris does not automatically transfer to all the police officers that may have been involved, as the court opined, and it doesn't transfer automatically to Harris. It's our position that it's opening up the process to abuse if you allow one defendant to default and then ride on the coattails of another defendant who happens to get summary judgment. I mean, it opens the process up to several perverse incentives. First of all, it opens up an incentive to plaintiffs, once they get a default judgment against one of all the co-defendants, to dismiss all the rest and proceed to hearing on the damages on the one that defaulted. And on the defense side, it creates, when you have a defendant like this one that is the city of that are employed by the city of Milwaukee, and that are represented by city attorneys, you have the incentive for them to pick the least culpable defendant and have that defendant answer, and we'll let the most culpable defendant default, and then we'll come back later after the first least culpable defendant gets a summary judgment in his favor and ride the coattails, let the culpable
defendant. In this case, the summary judgment was entered without any notice to your client. Is that right?
That's correct.
All right. Which you probably think was invalid.
I'm sorry?
Which you probably think is invalid.
Invalid,
okay.
Yes.
But it wasn't a correction made when, after you objected, that notice was given. Were you given an opportunity then to argue and submit affidavits?
I'm not sure that we were, and I don't think it would have been adequate in the first place if there's no defendant to litigate against. Again, it's asking the plaintiff to shadow box against a defendant that hasn't shown up. It's asking a plaintiff in advance, even once they get a summary judgment, to get a default judgment to build a case against that defaulting defendant, waste its own resources, waste the court's resources,
You keep shifting to default, and I keep shifting to summary judgment.
Okay. To answer directly, I would say that the court should never have the power to sua sponte enter a summary judgment against a defendant who has not appeared.
So you'd stop it at the first level, where with the default judgment, you'd stop it at the second level, the first level in both being whether the court has the power.
The court has the power to reopen a default judgment sua sponte.
But the court doesn't have the power to issue summary judgment sua sponte.
That's right.
But the court would have the power, even if the defendant, that's a question, even if the defendant didn't appear, to dismiss for failure to state a cause of action.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Wouldn't the trial court have the power to dismiss a complaint when it failed to state a cause of action? Even if there was no defendant appearing.
Only if we would maintain only if the court determined it was a frivolous complaint.
Only frivolous.
Yeah.
Can't supply qualified immunity affirmative defense.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. You'll have time in rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Pings, representing Carlos Rutherford. You represent the city, Ms. Pings?
No.
Okay.
Good morning. I am Rachel Pings, and may it please the court, I'm here on behalf of Carlos Rutherford, the defendant respondent in this case. In questioning of opposing counsel, the court has narrowed the issues pretty concisely to what they really are here. And my position would be that the court has the power in both instances, not only to sua sponte vacate a default, but also to sua sponte apply summary judgment to a party who did not move for it. Do I have a statute that specifically says that? I don't, but I think that the framework
of
the...
Do you have a case that says that?
I have, yes, I do. I have the Chedek State Bank case, the Johnson versus Gradzaluski, the Davis versus City of Elkhorn case, and the Tridal X Rel Shannon versus Horn case. Interestingly, none of those cases use 80607 to vacate a default. In those cases, the course of the proceeding began differently because the judge in that case said, ooh, I can foresee that if I give you a default, we're going to have to vacate it anyway, so why don't I hold off on the default until we decide the merits through summary judgment. When the merits were decided through summary judgment, even though the defendant had failed to timely appear, when the merits were decided, the plaintiff's complaint failed to state a claim.
Was there a motion for summary judgment in each of those cases?
Yes, and sometimes by the plaintiff.
But the law is different with regard to that. As long as there's a motion, if you look at 80208, summary judgment, and that's what we're talking about here, the law allows specifically for, you said there was a motion for summary judgment, but it was, you know, by the plaintiff. Under 80208 sub 6, there's the authority for the court, even if, let's say, Justice Butler was suing me, God forbid, and then he asks for summary judgment. The judge, in her wisdom, would say, no, Justice Bradley is the one that's entitled to summary judgment, and I would win. And that's, so that's why he doesn't sue me. No.
That's what happens when you're number six.
So 80208 sub 6 says specifically, if it shall appear to the court that the party against whom a motion for summary judgment is asserted is entitled to summary judgment, the summary judgment may be awarded to such party, even though the party has not moved for it.
Right.
So as I see the scheme under 80208 summary judgment, you have when it's available, that says sub 1, the heading is availability, and the first word says summary judgment, parentheses 1, parentheses, availability. A party may, within 8 days of the filing of the summons and complaint, move for summary judgment on any claim, counterclaim, blah, blah, blah. So I don't see any statutory authority for the court sui sponte to enter summary judgment here. Here is where there's a defaulting defendant in favor of that defaulting defendant. I don't see any statutory authority. So can you point to some other type of authority in a case where there wasn't first a motion made by someone for summary judgment? Can you help me with that?
Yeah, and then that's where I was going in terms of I don't have a statute that can point that I can point you to, but what I can say is that chapters 801 to 847, the civil procedure chapters, contain a lot of different statutes that say, let's not lose the forest through the trees. Let's make sure that if no party is prejudiced, we excuse technical procedural things. And I think that's what you have to focus on here. You've got a harmless error statute that specifically authorizes the court to excuse errors or defects in the pleading or proceeding which do not affect the substantial rights of the adverse party.
Can you give me, when you say there's a number of places in chapter 80, I don't know where you start, 801, I think, and following, where the court says, don't get hung up on the small things, folks. Look at the big picture. I'm paraphrasing. Which one are you relying? Because there are things like that.
Yes.
And so which one are you relying on or ones are you relying on as it would apply to whether the court has authority to sui sponte enter a summary judgment under these circumstances?
The one I was just referring to is 805.18 sub 1, and that's the harmless error statute. And it, in fact, mandates the court to excuse errors or defects when it doesn't affect the substantial rights of the other party.
Well, what's the error here? What's the error or defect?
Not pleading the affirmative defense in a timely fashion.
Well, he didn't plead anything.
That's right. Not pleading an affirmative defense.
So not pleading is a technical defect in your...
Well, I used that word. The statute doesn't use that word. And I'm not trying to diminish the importance of a timely proceeding. I realize that that's important, but at some point it has to submit to justice. And I think that that's where the civil procedure statutes give the court some room to move when there is an error or a defect in the pleadings or the proceedings.
Any other statute upon which you rely in the civil procedure statutes?
Yes, 802.09 sub 2, an issue not raised by the pleadings but tried by express or implied consent of the parties is treated as being appropriately raised. I think when Harris brought it up and Ms. Larry had every opportunity to dispute his contentions, which would have been the equivalent of Rutherford's, she had no prejudice by that being raised. And so, in effect, it can be translated to Mr. Rutherford as well by virtue of that statute.
So this 802.09 sub 2 deals with amendments. The heading, 802.09, right, is amended and supplemental pleadings. And sub 2 is amendments to conform to the evidence. So that's what you are relying on to allow the court in this situation to have sui sponte authority to enter summary judgment.
That and the harmless error statute, yes.
Okay.
And I agree that there is no case like we have the Estate of Persia case that says we interpret 806.07 sub 1 sub H to allow the court on its own motion to do something. I wish I had a case that I could point to that says that the court can do that, and I think that's why it's here today, because we don't have a case that says that.
How about any is there any argument to be made on inherent authority? I'm not saying there is inherent authority. I'm just asking, is there any argument that you think could or should be made on that? And if so, make it. And if not, say no. This isn't an inherent. I mean, courts have a lot of authority, but we only even our inherent authority right. is circumscribed. Is this one of those, or is it
sort of? I think that what the amicus brief focused on was the tenor of modern law and what direction do we want to be going in. Do we want to be going in a direction of let's play gotcha with the pleadings, or do we want to be going in a direction of we're going to get to the merits every single time that we possibly can? And if Mr. Rutherford had been the only one sued, I'm here to tell you he'd be paying damages or the city would be paying damages. It is true that it's only because it was a multi-defendant case that this is what happened. And he took a big risk by, if it was an acknowledged risk, by hoping that his co-defendant would take that step. That may not happen in other cases.
Let me tell you what troubles me about your argument, Ms. Pings. As I see it, there is a distinction between a circuit court judge sitting here on the basis of case A involving two parties saying, well, you know, on the basis of this decision, I've got this default against this party over here that the issues are kind of the same. And so in terms of letting a judgment out there stand, I'm not sure that that's justice. I'm not sure that's right. I'm not sure that that's a valid basis for keeping the judgment out there and invoking 80607 to reopen.
Mm-hmm.
I see that as being very different from then going the next step and saying in the absence of a party and in the absence of any pleadings and in the absence of any motion for summary judgment, saying, and now I'm going to take the next step and enter a judgment with respect to a party that I don't even have jurisdiction over yet because that party has never, ever submitted themselves to the jurisdiction of this court.
Mm-hmm. And that's a problem. That's one evil in your one hand, and then you've got another evil in your other, and you have to pick which one is less evil because there's no way to make that perfect. You're going to have times when, and you said they're kind of the same facts. They're exactly the same facts. The complaint in this case alleges...
Well, how do we know they're exactly the same facts? Rutherford has never responded to the facts.
Because she frames the allegations of her own complaint. And all that she said is X, Y, and Z happened. She affirms that through her affidavits. Her niece, who was the babysitter, affirms that through her affidavits. Harris and the other officer who was unnamed affirm those things. There's no lack of facts here. Everybody knows what happened. And when it's qualified immunity in particular, and it applies to the...
Wasn't there a dispute in the facts with respect to the Harris case? Well, didn't she assert some things that Harris, in fact, asserted were not true? In terms of who went into the house and in terms of who did what?
Well, no, it ended up that Harris was in the house for a few minutes and possibly the other officer was, but it was never Rutherford, and everybody agreed on that. And that regardless of what the officers or officer who was in the house did, it did not rise to the level of an unreasonable search and seizure under the Fourth Amendment. So no matter who did what, she, which is her burden, which the trial court appropriately cited the case law, that it was her burden to prove in a qualified immunity analysis that the law was clearly established at the time, and she failed to do that. That was her burden, and she failed to do it, so qualified immunity attaches to any reasonable officer at that time. I mean, it sort of is unique to the qualified immunity defense. I'm not sure what we're talking about today would translate as easily to other affirmative defenses, and I haven't thought that out too much.
My recollection was that... there was an officer, maybe a sergeant or somebody, mm-hmm. Foster.
Yes.
And didn't he acknowledge that he had gone into the house?
Yes, they...
And isn't he covered by the order of the court, the summary judgment?
Yes.
Didn't he benefit from that?
Yes.
As a John Doe or Roe or something?
Yes.
All right. How would this play out if you do not prevail? This is remanded and there is a hearing. How would this play out?
Well, I think we're at a loss because we don't know whether Officer Rutherford really did choose not to do these things. I think that he may be able to prove excusable neglect and try to reopen the default. So I think what you talked about when opposing counsel was arguing is what's likely to happen. We're going to use either 80607, one of its subparts, to try and get the default reopened. And if that's successful, then we already know what's going to happen. We know the merits. He can move for qualified immunity, and he'll win that. If we're unsuccessful in reopening the default, we will try to mitigate or diminish the damages as much as possible.
And who would pay the damages?
probably the city, although, as opposing counsel aptly pointed out, they may not roll over and do that, but I think ultimately they would end up paying it.
And who finances the city? That's a taxpayer.
Yes.
What would happen if the court would decide that there was no erroneous exercise of discretion? What's the next step in entering a default judgment? What's the next step then, procedurally, do you think?
Are you talking about that the judge did not abuse his discretion in reopening the default?
That's right. Then where, in your mind, if this court would decide that and say, no, the court has power, I mean, it seems like everyone agrees
yes.
that in terms of the counsel, the court has power, sui sponte, to vacate a default judgment. I hope I'm not overstepping. That's what I understood anyway. The question is whether or not, given that power authority, it was erroneously exercised, and your opposing counsel says it was erroneously exercised because it didn't go through the two steps. And blah, blah, blah. Let's say the court decides that there was no erroneous exercise of discretion. The court has the authority to reopen or vacate a default judgment and did so properly here.
Mm-hmm.
What then? In your mind, how does that leave you? What's the procedure?
Yeah. So we would say, what's the procedural posture then?
Well, I think that at that point, what didn't happen because Judge Noonan did it at the same time, he vacated the default and did the summary judgment all at the same time, what would happen is now the default is vacated and Mr. Rutherford can appear and we can appear for him and allege the qualified immunity defense in a timely fashion, and we're left right where we are right now, which is qualified immunity applies.
That's not what happened at the trial court level.
Right.
Okay.
Because so. the default was vacated at the same time that summary judgment was awarded to Mr. Rutherford.
Can you award summary judgment without giving notice to everybody?
Did Ms.
Larry get notice?
I have trouble understanding how there was no notice, given that there were briefs and pleadings and possibly oral argument back and forth regarding whether summary judgment would be ordered. I understand
as
that
to
Ms.
Whom?
Larry was
to
taken by surprise that it was ordered for Mr. Rutherford as well. I understand that. There wasn't specific notice given to Ms. Larry.
Because that case only involved Harris.
Right.
All right.
And so I think that when she wrote her letter saying, whoa, I object to this, I didn't realize you were going to do this, the court said, that's fair enough, I'll let you move to reconsider. She did so, and I think you'll see from the record that she specifically declined oral argument on that issue. So I think if, you know,
to submit briefs?
Yes.
Did Mr. Rutherford?
No, the city did.
In the summary judgment?
In the motion to reconsider. And in the summary judgment. Because, you know, the city of Milwaukee wasn't...
So he appeared.
I'm sorry?
No, they didn't represent him.
Right.
So he didn't appear.
No, he did not appear in the motion.
A friend of the court coming in.
Sort of. It's sort of if you
They're
don't find...
friends of the court.
If you don't find in my favor, I'm going to have to pay this probably. So we have a big interest in doing this. I mean, they kind of were representing their interest in Rutherford. But
they
not...
Didn't
they weren't
represent
Rutherford. They were not representing Rutherford at that time, no. And they did not appear on his behalf.
Should the court let him in? Are they in an intervening party? Are they? Do they virtually represent Rutherford? I mean, somehow it seems a little... They're not labeled amicus, are they?
I'm sorry?
They're not labeled friend of the court.
No. They're appearing as counsel for Mr. Harris because she moved to reconsider parts of the summary judgment decision that affected
Mr. Harris.
But they're
not even there for Rutherford. They're there for Harris.
That's right, but they argued things that applied to Mr. Rutherford.
Okay. All right. So now there's a reconsideration of the summary judgment against Rutherford, and there's no oral argument briefs, right?
Yes.
And the judge reaffirms his summary judgment.
Yes. And I think
anything bother you about this procedure?
Sure. As I've said, it's not perfect. you're picking between two evils. I'm not here to say it's perfect.
One of the things is, as I read the amicus brief, which you relied on, it, I don't think, deals at all with the summary judgment. It deals only with opening up the default. And its position, if I understand it, which is, I think, the position in many cases, that the court, that summary judgment is not favored.
I'm sorry, summary
judgment? Summary judgment is not favored in the law. You want to give a person a day in court.
Mm-hmm.
That we have procedural rules and they have advantages and they're important, but you still have the issue of giving the person in a day in court. And that's why you have 80607 that says here are seven reasons why you should open up a summary judgment. Mm-hmm. Many of them are not very onerous, right?
A default, you mean?
A default,
right?
I'm okay. Sorry. Mm-hmm. And if it's in a year, it's pretty automatic, if I remember the law. Mm-hmm. All right. But that's a lot different than entering a judgment on the merits. I mean, how would you feel if he entered a judgment on the merits against your client? The judge said, you're right. Rutherford is different than Harris. The complaint against Rutherford is different. Rutherford never appeared. I'm going to give you summary judgment, Ms. Lowry.
Mm-hmm. It's a totally different case. If she'd have pled different facts, that may have happened, and I couldn't complain.
She does have a different fact scenario.
Well, the only difference is she says Mr. Rutherford basically witnessed this happen and didn't stop it.
And you don't think that's good enough, but suppose the judge thought it was good enough and entered summary judgment. Summary judgment may be an error, but nobody showed up for Mr. Rutherford. Mm-hmm. Nobody complained. The judge reached a decision. You'd come in here and you'd argue that the court had no authority to reach a decision without giving Mr. Rutherford an opportunity on summary judgment.
Not if he had a default against him and didn't try to vacate that default, or if the judge didn't do it sua sponte.
Let me ask this. It's kind of in follow-up to the Chief's question. Mm-hmm. You have the situation where Judge Noonan looked at this judgment against Mr. Rutherford, said, based on what I did with Mr. Harris's case, I'm going to vacate the default. Now, let's assume, for sake of argument, he stopped there and then schedule it for a hearing or schedule for summary judgment, provided notice to Ms. Lowry, provided notice to Mr. Rutherford. Day comes for the hearing. Rutherford still doesn't show up. What should happen?
Default.
Well, if that's the case, and you would agree that default should happen in that situation, and I'm assuming that's for finality of judgments, forcing the parties to attend the court, then I guess I'm somewhat concerned about the step that's left out, the not providing the notice for summary judgment, not giving that notice to Mr. Lowry, not giving that notice to Mr. Rutherford, not allowing the parties to come and engage. And part of the reason I'm concerned is because otherwise courts are going to be faced with situations, not in this case, let's forget this case, but in future litigation involving businesses, involving other matters, where a party just doesn't show and doesn't care, and the courts are still going to reach the merits and make decisions perhaps in their favor, notwithstanding the fact that they're ignored by the parties. That there's something that's very disturbing about that prospect.
Well, and I think I can't disagree with that's a problem. I think that the fact that Lowry did not get notice but then had a chance to air her grievances with what had happened, and none of those grievances included anything to do with the merits. And so the notice problem is sort of saved by the fact that the judge got it right. And if he hadn't, the opportunity for the motion to reconsider would have been the opportunity to get it right.
But under your situation, the judge would have had that information already available at the time
in the hypothetical where Judge Noonan reopened the case and rescheduled it. Mm-hmm. Yet you agree that if Larry then blows it off again, and not Larry, if Mr. Rutherford blows off the hearing again and doesn't show up, that it should be a default. And I guess at what point do we have to hold the parties to their responsibility to join the action?
Well, at that point, because you've given him now the opportunity to do that, and he now understands that the law as it applies to Harris is not going to apply to him, and if he continues to be absent without a good reason, without excusable neglect or something else, unless this court finds it appropriate to set some sort of extraordinary circumstance test in that case as well, then I think the only answer is default, and that's where you draw the line.
Is there an argument to be made that this case is unique because of the qualified immunity issue? We had a case a bit ago that dealt with, I think, governmental immunity. And one of the many arguments advanced was that we should craft a new procedure for governmental immunity cases allowing for a direct appeal. You know, mm-hmm. The argument was, why put the government, it might be normally an interlocutory issue, but why put the government through the whole trial, through the whole discovery, through the whole every other process? So let's craft, and this is one of the sub-issues, but let's craft for immunity cases the authority to have a direct appeal. You know? And if my recollection serves me correctly, we declined to do that, but of course encouraged Court of Appeals to take the permissive appeal, to mm-hmm. grant permissive appeals. But is there anything to be said, and I'm not sure there is, I'm just exploring it, because this case involves qualified immunity, because it was fully, in the court's mind, fully briefed and argued as to any officer, does that make any difference at all?
Yes, and I think I did mention that a little earlier, is that I haven't thought really out to its extension how other affirmative defenses would be affected by this, because I'm not sure that they would apply as easily to all the defendants when you've got, you know, the same fact scenario. So, yes, I think it is, and I think it's also unique in that the qualified immunity has that sort of same thing as the sovereign immunity, where you don't even want to put them through vigorous discovery if qualified immunity is going to attach.
One of the problems with that is the whole slippery slope. I mean, can you really confine it, this unique, made for this case circumstance, can you confine it to qualified immunity? All of a sudden, does it get a little broader and go to other defenses, mm-hmm. affirmative defenses? And I don't know the answer to that. I just haven't thought.
Well, and I don't either, but I think that you at some point have to give the trial courts some discretion to say, is this the type of affirmative defense that does easily translate to all the defendants, like qualified immunity, or isn't it? And if it isn't, then your same, whatever rule you come down with today is not going to apply.
In response to Justice Butler, he asked you, if the trial court opened the default judgment against Mr. Rutherford and then had scheduled a hearing, mm-hmm. and Mr. Rutherford did not appear again, what would happen? And you said the court would enter a default judgment. But what the court did, that's right?
Yes.
What the court did here was enter a summary judgment. Now, both the default judgment and the summary judgment are judgments on the merit with the plaintiff losing, right?
Both default and summary?
No. We mean with prejudice.
I didn't mean on the merit. I meant with prejudice.
Vacating the default and granting the summary judgment.
Well, if the trial court entered a default judgment, that is with prejudice, and you can't bring the case again mm-hmm. unless you open it again, mm-hmm. right?
Okay.
And you said that on the second time he didn't appear, it would be a default judgment, which would dismiss the case on the merits, dismiss the case with prejudice, sorry. But in this case, the trial court entered a summary judgment, which too is a dismissal with prejudice. So does it matter that the trial court entered a summary judgment than a default judgment? Or is it irrelevant what the judge called it? Because in both instances, it was a dismissal with prejudice.
As I stand here, I'm not seeing a significant difference. I think that it, in effect, disposed of all the issues as to Mr. Rutherford, so whatever he called it, it had the same effect. But I want to be clear, if I wasn't, in response to Justice Butler's question, I only went that far in saying I think default should apply if you say that notice is required and you had the summary judgment motion hearing and he still didn't apply. And that, I think, presumes that you didn't already have one of those qualified immunity defenses that translates to all defendants. I don't think that that would make a difference in this case. I don't think that should be the outcome in a case like this, because the other side, whether they had notice or in a motion to reconsider, were able to make up that notice, they made no complaints about the merits being right, that he should have gotten summary judgment. Now,
here's the problem as I see it, though, and I want to take it away from this case for a moment. Once we get to the point where we say that circuit courts should be making decisions on the merits of the matter in the absence of a response, in the absence of a pleading, in the absence of a party, if we do it here, I'm not sure that how we can say that we can't do it in other types of proceedings. Mm-hmm. And that's the danger that I see, that is, if you're going to do it in this case and then you're going to apply it to business matters, you're going to apply it to family matters, you're going to apply it to other matters, then when do judgments become final? And do the courts have an obligation to reach the merits on any case regardless of whether there's a response? That seems to be contrary to the statutory scheme. Mm-hmm. That's the concern that I have. It's one thing, as I understand the argument, to try to reopen a judgment that you question as a circuit judge in terms of its validity. It's another thing to go the next step and make all of the rulings on the merits. And that's what's missing for me here, because if we say it's okay here, then shouldn't circuit judges be doing it in all types of matters?
But I think you've got to err on one side or the other, and if a judge has the power to sua sponte, bring up a qualified immunity defense or some other affirmative defense, if it comes to the judge's attention either from the judge's own spark of his brain or from somebody else, a party, why shouldn't that control? I think that it should. Whether nobody shows up at all, you've got a pleading, you've got a complaint which states facts. And then you've got the burden on that complaining party to say these violate some law. And if they don't, then it was a void complaint in the first place. It failed to state a proper claim. And cases do that all the time. They then give summary judgment in the favor of the party who the complaint was against that did not state a proper claim. I see that my time has finished. If there's other questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bing. Mr. Porter.
Mr. Porter, if I could ask you a question right out of the box. We've thought of this, and it seems like it makes a lot of sense for both directions. When you carry it out to a business setting or other cases where someone doesn't assert a defense and default is entered, that they ought not come in and unravel all of that later. But a very typical group of facts under which a trial court judge might find themselves in regularly administered justice, I think, is, for example, in a small claims matter where you have a husband and a wife who are sued, and the husband shows up but not the wife. You know, technically, the court should grant default judgment against that wife. But routinely, courts will say, you know, I'm going to figure out this issue on the merits. And then, you know, technically you're in default, but unless it really a judgment should issue, it doesn't make sense here to issue judgment against the wife, for example, for not showing up in court. You know, every day of the week, judges administer justice, and that, in the end, is their duty and their role. I worry about us creating, tying judges' hands to administer justice. Can you address that?
Yes, I don't know that I can speak specifically to the small claims procedure because I'm not very familiar with that. But
it could be a special statute covering that.
Well, it could be any case where you have, you know, a parent who shows up on behalf of a child, or, you know, there a parent who shows up on behalf of their 18-year-old. I think situations like that occur, and judges don't necessarily enter default against that. They use their discretion and decide. Now, that's the scenario I'm talking about.
I think that the judge's decision and discretion to enter a default judgment is different than it is to reopen it. But I think that it should not be any easier to reopen than it is to grant it in the first place. And I think that's the problem with the trial court's decision here and with the decision of the Court of Appeals, because under the decision in the court today is that all that a party has to assert or all that the judge has to conclude is that the party could have had a meritorious defense, and it doesn't matter, you know, why the person didn't show up, and it doesn't matter. It shifts all of the burdens in the case against the party that showed up. You know, the entire argument on behalf of Mr. Rutherford here regarding summary judgment is that Harris's contentions would have been the contentions of Rutherford, but we don't know that. That's an inference that now has been construed against the plaintiff because she didn't develop a case against Rutherford when he had defaulted. You know, the presumption should be against the defendant that doesn't show up. The presumption should be against the defendant that doesn't file an affirmative defense, that doesn't file a motion for summary judgment. And to allow the plaintiff to have to to require the plaintiff to have to shadow box against a phantom defendant that doesn't even show up and assume what that defendant's going to say or do or show how this is different. There could have been any number of ways for Larry to show that Rutherford's facts were different than those of Harris. And qualified immunity is a fact-specific determination.
And that makes this unique, the qualified immunity issue. If, for example, the judge enters default against the wife for not showing up, but then they go through the trial and the plaintiff can't prove their case, you think it then would, too, be unreasonable for the judge to vacate that default?
Yes. I think the judge should require the wife or require something that establishes or proves extraordinary factors as to why the wife didn't bother to show up. I mean, isn't this if it's not important to her, why should it be important to the court? I mean, why should the presumption be against the party who cared enough to come to the court? Our system of justice is based upon cases and controversies in an adversarial process where people show up to stand up for their positions. It's not that the courts aren't allowed to go around and solve problems for people that don't bother to submit themselves to the court. You just open up a Pandora's box if you do that. You destroy any meaning for default judgments, any security for it. The default judgment statute becomes meaningless because any defendant who later comes along and says, oh, well, gee, you know, now I'm going to come and I feel like showing up here and I've got a great defense, so let's go, you know, or just grant it because I've said I've got a great defense or because it's kind of like this other guy that had a great defense. I mean, that's just not how the system is supposed to work. Larry was prepared to litigate against Rutherford. She was prepared, if he showed up, to take his deposition, to show why that he was liable under the accusations of the complaint. He didn't show up. And now she's faulted because she didn't go ahead and prove these facts anyway. It just is fundamentally unfair.
Mr. Porter, there are some unusual facts here that I would love to know. As though I were editor of the National Enquirer or something, I'm not going to ask those things. But, I mean, occasionally, hard as it is to believe, members of the court are sued. We're named defendants. We don't rush to court. I mean, we just assume someone is going to defend us. Did the circuit court, I'm not going to ask a follow-up question, but did the circuit court have information that this court doesn't have?
We believe that Larry had the potential. Yeah, there's information in the record that Larry said that the officers in the house were in there for 20 minutes, that they questioned the children, that they asked the children where she was and who was she with and what was she doing that night. Now, that arguably goes beyond the care.
That's not the director.
I'm sorry. I said I would not ask a follow-up question.
So?
You're not held to that, Justice Brass.
You have inherent authority if you want.
Oh, okay. I can tell you what I think as to why he didn't show up.
Well, maybe.
Don't tell us.
All right. But I don't, I guess what I would ask this court to do would be to construe the inferences against him, especially considering that the court is entitled to take notice of 895-46, where he's entitled to a defense. And he's paid for by the city. And his fellow officer took advantage of that, and he didn't.
Took advantage of it late.
And he did so late. But he did it. I think that this court, when the Court of Appeals, for example, construed the first factor in the MLB test as the second factor, did he have access to legal representation, that isn't neutral. You can't just say, oh, he didn't show up and give him the benefit, that makes it neutral. You should say, he didn't show up. We have to assume that he chose not to show up. We have to assume that he could have gone like any other party that showed up in the case could have gone to a lawyer and shown up. And especially in this case where you have a police officer who's sworn to uphold the law, who arrested my client because he believes she wasn't following the law and held her accountable for that, and then he thumbs his nose at the court, doesn't bother to even show up when he's served with process and served with a motion for default judgment. And doesn't even show up in the motion, in the reconsideration process to defend himself and to say, you know, don't reconsider, judge. Doesn't even show up there. That plus the statute, I think, leads us to the conclusion that he willfully decided that his rights weren't important enough to get justice on. And I don't see where a court can say that its conscience is incessantly telling us that it has to give justice to somebody like that that just doesn't even care enough to show up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Porter, and thank you, Ms. Pings, for your arguments today on this case. We now close the hearing on 05 AP 2935, Larry versus Harris et al. The court will be in recess until 1:30 for its last case today. The students will remain in the courtroom, and Justice Crooks will be out momentarily to discuss the case with you. Everybody's invited to stay for the discussion. We are in recess.